Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is me.
A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact scenario.
I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Onto a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah.
This is Tech Talk.
Good morning. It is Tech Talk. Half of the team is here today again. We got Michael Tech Talk Hassler talking at you right now. And going to be a great show, though. I'm really excited about what we've got going on today. I didn't get a chance to preview it for you last week because this happened so quick over this last week that there was no time to promo and stuff. But we're going to have on in just a little while Tom Standage, who is from the UK branch of The Economist, and he's going to talk to us all about the really, really cool tech stuff that was just released in The Economist magazine recently. I'm sure you've heard of it, seen it, but they do have a quarterly tech update, and there was such a wealth of incredibly interesting things going on right now that The Economist covered. Tom is just going to be a great, great talk for us a little bit later here. And before that, of course, we will not be missing the inimitable, the ubiquitous Jay Garman, who's going to come on and tell us the geek trivia answer from last week. If you were listening in, something new to think about this week. We're missing Dave Saganaki this week. My co-host is off again and running around somewhere up north, but hey, well-deserved and good for him. We'll catch up with him hopefully in another week or so. And on all, but that means that I have free rein on anything I want to talk about. So... So you guys are in for a treat today. I'll try to keep us on track, at least somewhat. We've got people over the ocean here we're trying to talk to today. It's been a big day for WRLR, talking to people all over the world. Just the sports guys just left. They were talking to some of the folks out in South Africa. And that, of course, was related to the World Cup stuff, which is really neat, really fun, really great. Blast to watch on TV, except, of course, for all those darn horns and the buzzing and the blatting and the other stuff. And you can't understand what anybody's saying. You know, you're hearing about this on the news. Of course, if you're not watching the World Cup, you probably still are hearing about people's pain and frustration with these darn what are they called, the Vuvuzela horns. I'm not sure how to pronounce it exactly. What I can help you do, though, is get rid of that annoying vuvuzela, that buzzing that sounds like someone put about 100 flies inside of a jar and held it next to your head and shook it. That sound. There is actually a really great website you can go to that's got a piece of software that you can download. If you're going to listen to it on your computer, it'll do it automatically for your computer. If you're not going to listen to it on your computer, you can use your computer as a pass-through device for the audio from your TV or anywhere else, and it will actually filter it. It turns out it's quite a simple process conceptually for how to remove these. The vuvuzela, you know what? The horns. I'm just going to call them the horns. We'll skip over the whole vuvuzela thing. The horns that you're hearing tend to make noise on a specific set of frequencies audially. They're not like, you know, what I would consider a true musical horn. They're not designed to make notes and tones and different ranges of sound. All of them make pretty much the same sound. It's either louder or softer, that's all. Well, the irritating thing about that, of course, is that it's just this constant buzzing that you can't get past. But the nice thing about it for us on the audio and digital processing side of things is that if you want to remove that sound, you just have to remove the basic frequency, which turns out to be around 233 hertz. You apply a notch filter to it, you apply some harmonics to it, and bang, before you know it, all of a sudden the background noises and the people being excited about being at the game and the announcers and all that starts to come through. So I'm going to direct you to this place. If you go to decibel.ni.com, you're going to need to look for a blog by a guy named Simon, Simon H., and he just did a fantastic rundown on how to take the audio from your TV and pump it out through your speakers on your computer using a piece of software that you can download from there that will completely filter out the horns. So give that a shot. I know there's a lot of World Cup fanatics out there, and people really excited about the games and what's happening. I sadly have to count myself out of that group of people. I think I'm probably a traditional ugly American and just have never gotten into the whole association football, soccer, whatever you want to call it, world. I'll be as patriotic and jingoistic as anybody else if the Americans do actually wind up going anywhere with it, but I'm not going to pretend to you that I'm all hopped up on World Cup fever here in the meantime. But I do feel your pain with those horns. I've watched just enough of it to be irritated by it myself, and hopefully that'll help a little bit. other kind of big news, or unrelated news anyways, is it's kind of interesting. We've talked a number of times about Google and their Wi-Fi data collection policies and what they have or have not done and what they intended or did not intend to do and so on. And they claimed early on that, and I do believe that this was just an accidental thing, that they didn't mean to do this. And that, anyways, the information they collected, there wasn't all that much of it, and they were going to get rid of it. Well, it turns out in a recent article, the French Data Protection Authority has gone through some of this Wi-Fi data to see exactly what it was that was intercepted. And what did they find? Well, of course, passwords, emails, network access information, all of this, the stuff that you would hate to have people know and find and get from you. I think this tells us a couple things. One is that anytime you're collecting information that's on the networks, you can't assume that it's clean, that it doesn't have incriminating information. But the other thing too is it's shocking to me, I guess, how many people have these wide open Wi-Fi networks. I have a Wi-Fi network. The basic level of security you can apply to it, WEP key stuff, which is so easy to break anyways, at the very least, if you do that, it keeps a casual drive-by sort of interception from happening. This just kind of is almost a case in point here for convincing someone would-be hacker to say, this didn't take Google any effort. What the heck? They put a laptop in a car and drove around for a couple of hours and got credit card numbers, passwords, emails, et cetera, on. And not only that, they weren't even trying. If I did this and I wanted to do it, I could record where these open Wi-Fi locations are. Maybe I don't get the vital, really cool information that I need to take over this guy's bank account this pass through, but I'll note it and I'll just go back and drive around there again an hour or two later. Now, I'm not saying that people should do this. I'm not saying that I'm going to do this. I'm saying this is what somebody out there is certainly thinking when they see this information that was available to Google without even trying. And that's frightening. And if you've listened to our show enough, you're certainly somewhat aware of what an SSID is and why you shouldn't broadcast it. You should be somewhat aware of what basic security on your router is. If you have a Wi-Fi router in your house, if you have wireless connectivity in your home today and you don't know what these things are, please just go Google it, figure it out. Pay someone to stop by your house. Get your son-in-law to come on over and get that stuff configured and do that. That would be a very cool thing. So I've said enough. You've heard me go on about that before. One thing though, I do have a personal pet peeve here. I gotta share with you. When we're on the topic of pet peeves, you may or may not know. I don't know if I've talked about this much, but I'm a big runner. I love to run. Love to do. Join in a lot of the community races, the 5Ks, the 10Ks, and the so on that are going on around here. And every year, one of my favorite ones is out in Vernon Hills, and it's called Run from the Cops, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It's put on by the police department, and you set off and you do your 5K, and it's just a lot of fun, and there's a carnival going on at the same time and all that. It's great. Well, anyways, they're sending out emails to alert you to say, hey, you know, you got to sign up for these again. Don't forget, it's coming up in another month, and which is great. I love getting those little reminders, and you know, it tweaks me to make sure that I sign up and remember to get started prepping for it and all that. Here's my pet peeve. When you send out an email to a group of people, and especially to a group of people that don't know each other, or you don't know specifically who they are, please put that list of emails into the BCC area, at the very least, the blind copy, carbon copy. Ideally, in fact, what you would do is use a mail merge application to just create individual emails with the to line being the email that you want. And that's not that tough to do. And I bring it up because it is a personal pet peeve of mine. I hate getting an email like that where I can see, you know, literally 250 some odd emails from people that are very specific and unknown to each other. And that list could be so easily grabbed by anybody and say, oh my gosh, I now have a verified, a valid list of runners, a valid list of people that are interested in supporting their community, a valid active list of people that are local. You know, what a valuable spam tool that is. Am I being cynical today? Maybe I'm just being cynical today, but I'm looking on the bad side. So I did alert the group that was sending those out to next time around do that. But if you're one of those people that's sending out emails a lot to large groups of people, whether it's for personal use or for business use, you know, that's my one request of you today is to keep that in your head, is say, did I make it so that everybody could see the emails? Because you don't want to do that. All right, I'll get off of my high horse. I spent a lot of time complaining today. I don't know why that is. I'm a little bit under the weather. And like I said, too, of course, we've got Mr. Saganaki has left us for the day. So he's leaving. You know, it's me unchained. Let's get Jay on here, though, to kind of rein things in a little bit and see what we can get from our geek trivia guru and answer the questions from last week.
Hello.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Garman. That was quick. I was afraid I was going to surprise you this morning because we were I don't know if you call this on time or early or what. I don't know where we're supposed to be at anymore.
Well, it's between 11 and 12 my local time, so you're good.
Oh, okay, fair enough. I like that. I need a lot of buffer, so that that works out very well. Very well. Oh, man. So I hope the weather is as refreshingly nice today for you as it is for us. We had some rough times last night, but the weather today is gorgeous. So I don't know if are you one of those people that's going to stick yourself in side, close all the shutters, and just go World Cup all the time?
Oh, no. I'm not a soccer guy in any remote sense of the word. So, yes, I've been outside. It's wonderful. The rain came through and has kept the grass so wet that I don't have to mow it, which is a great gift to a guy on Father's Day weekend. And I can't go out and mow that, honey. It's still wet from the rainstorm. I'll clog the mower.
Okay. Awesome.
Wonderful
awesome.
Gift from Mother Nature there.
I didn't even look at it in that light. You're absolutely right. It's great to hear you say that you're not one of the World Cup fanatics, because I just revealed that I also was that I just wasn't going to pretend that I was really excited about the whole thing. So although
I found in my experience that geeks being, you know, sort of like innately counterculture often just sort of faux adopt soccer because it's not a mainstream sport. And I just don't have the energy for that. I just don't have the, you know, I'm really into this. You know, I'm Real Madrid. That's my team. Like, not really, you know?
Yep. Yeah, I've heard a lot of people, you know, saying, oh, just so long as Brazil doesn't win. You know, it's like, why do you care if it's Brazil or not? I don't know. But
yeah, are there a lot of, you know, people from Rio that just talk smack in your office? Is that what's going on here? I mean, it's not like there's some sort of personal impact from the World Cup winning. And frankly, I'm going to come down with a sports radio host, Colin Cowherd, on this. It's sort of arrogant on the United States' part to think that we deserve to be good at World Cup soccer, because we send, and this is no offense to our soccer players, like our fourth or fifth tier athletes into professional soccer in the United States. If you were really talented young athlete, you're going to get funneled into football, basketball, baseball, or maybe hockey. You know, that's where you're going to get funneled by our sort of sports industry system. So if you end up playing professional soccer, you know, it's like we don't have any LeBron James equivalent at professional soccer. We don't have any Albert Pujols equivalent at professional soccer. That's where our stars go. So to think that our fifth best guy should be able to go out there and beat like countries like Brazil or Italy, who put their best people in soccer, it's just plain American arrogance.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And even our professional soccer teams here in America are made up to a great degree by non-birth Americans. You know, people that have moved, their first generation moved here. In fact, my cab driver, when I went to the airport, he claimed anyways that he was an ex-professional soccer player, but he was from Poland and had played for Spain and then moved to America for the big money. And found out that it turns out there really isn't any big money in professional soccer.
The Premiership leagues and some of the European stuff, I think there is some big money. But it's funny, when the United States does produce like a serious American soccer player, they leave here and go play in Europe.
Yes.
You know, that whenever I see any of the World Cup coverage of our players, it's, you know, it's like, well, you know, he did some time in Spain. You know, he played in the Greek league. Like, okay, this is what's going on. Mm-hmm. Their great basketball players come here. Our great soccer players go there.
Exactly.
And no one plays football like us. So,
yeah, there's not really anywhere else to go. If you want to play football.
Prison, probably. I quote Deacon Jones, the great, you know, Rams defensiveman, you know, for that. Like, where'd you hear that professional football? I'd be in prison.
Oh, man. And, of course, nowadays, even that's not keeping a lot of them out of prison. But
no.
I did go and find out. This is my geek trivia point of the week. I can't remember where I pulled this up on. I think it might have been from HowStuffWorks.com or one of those places. But I've just always, it always has nagged me, is like, why soccer is, and why football? You know, what? Because, of course, everywhere else, what we call soccer is called football. And they don't know what to call our stuff. You know, American football is the only thing they can call our thing. And I did find that out, is that it turns out that in the at the time when the sport was becoming popular, which wasn't that long ago in Europe, it was actually referred to as association football. And that split into two distinct sports. And what we call football was kind of this mixed rugby kind of weird thing. And then what they continued to call football, we called association football, and then shortened it to SOCH, and then just a sock and soccer. I, you know, somehow it made this weird mix. But I thought I'd never known that. I thought it was very interesting, at least to know why. Because I've, you know, it's like everybody calls it something different. It's tough to keep it straight when you talk to your friends from England or from Europe, anywhere, to know what anybody's talking about.
That's absolutely true. And our version of football will never become an Olympic sport, because it's got to be played in organized fashion in at least 70 countries or something to be a men's sport. So it's just never going to happen.
No. No, that, you're absolutely right. Yeah, we'll never see that. And you know what? That's that's probably okay. I think that's that's just fine. So Jay, let's see if we can keep as close to on time as I was hoping to be. I've got I'm very curious about the answer for last week's question, where we had a discussion about we're on the 27th anniversary of Pioneer 10 leaving the solar system, and it's passing the orbit of Neptune, and there's these plaques on them, and there's information, and I think what you had said, what you were asking, was there's only two pieces of information that have appeared every time that we've sent out these ships to put our presence out in the universe, and what those two pieces of information were, and I have no idea what they would have felt important enough to make sure appeared on every single piece of equipment that made it out of the solar system.
Right. Well, we've only put these kind of messages on four craft: Pioneer 10 and 11, and Voyager 1 and 2. Pioneer 10 and 11 had the same plaque, just replicated over, and then on the Voyager, we did those famous golden records. And on one side was basically a phonograph record, and the other side was etchings. And Carl Sagan was involved in both of the designs, and as we talked about last time, on the Pioneer plaques, there were depictions of a nude human male and female, which got really controversial. So they had to completely go back to formula, if you will, for the Voyager golden records. And the only two pieces of information they kept was an image of the transition of hydrogen from positive to negative. Basically, it's called the hyperfine transition of neutral hydrogen, basically the addition subtraction of an electron, and a pulsar map that shows the location of our sun relative to 14 pulsars in our galaxy, and the pulsars are spelled out. Now, the reason the hydrogen is there is it's the most abundant element in the universe, and we're basically showing that if you can figure out this is hydrogen, you'll understand we're using two-dimensional line drawings to convey information. So basically, that's sort of our signpost. And then from that, the pulsar map, you'll be able to understand that we're using a two-dimensional image of something real, and you'll be able to figure out that these lines show the periods of pulsars. If you figure out where the 14 pulsars are that have those exact periods that we mark out on these sort of line graphs, you'll be able to figure out what star in the middle of that map is, and sort of you'll assume that's where these probes came from. So those are the only two things that we've put on all of those. And we put some version of this is sort of in the archives, so if we ever decide to do these messages again, those will probably get reused because those are sort of our two baselines, especially the hydrogen. This shows you that we use two-dimensional images to convey information.
I can see that. That makes sense. I mean, you know, trying to establish some way to communicate, you know, even a basic piece of information with such an unknown receiver at the end is pretty tough, a pretty tough concept. So
what's really funny though is that they threw out the line drawings of the human male and female. Some people say it is because they were too abstract to have any meaning to form the alien intelligences, but mostly because it's you know, controversial. But on the Voyager golden records, they set up a system of encoding images, basically dot matrix drawings, into the audio, you know, of the record. Uh-huh. And included in that were images of human sex organs and diagrams of human procreation. So they actually got more controversial images into the golden records. They just wouldn't show up in the newspapers as etchings on the back. You would have to actually decode the record to find them.
Oh, man. So so they sent out Debbie Does Delta and on these records and with images. Now we just need to get the moving pictures next, and we'll be all set. Little holograms. And man. Well, if their aliens ever come here, they'll know exactly what to expect. So that's good.
I'm not sure whether we've been too honest or not honest enough.
Yeah, exactly. So awesome. Well, yeah, I had no idea. I knew we had sent a lot of information up, but that makes a lot of sense, making that guideline. So what should we be thinking about for next week?
Well, I'm going to do some more space stuff because it plays so well with the crowds. And just this week, the Hayabusa probe from Japan, we think, brought back some samples from an asteroid. We're not certain yet because we haven't been able to, we haven't set up the proper procedures for opening its sample case that landed in the Australian outback. But we think it set back some samples, which brings me to the notion of successfully landing space probes on non-planets. To sort of set this up, there are three kinds of probes. Impactors, which are things we just designed to crash into other stuff. That's easy to do. Orbiters, throw something out there and get it to orbit. And then things that can safely and functionally land on something. That's the really hard stuff. Then you add onto that our three kinds of targets. The moon, really easy. It's right there. Other planets, nice and big. And then non-planets that aren't our moon. And so Hayabusa combined the hardest kind of probe with the hardest kind of target. And they pulled it off. In fact, they pulled off something that's really rare. We've only done this three times. So what are the three probes that we've sent out that have successfully landed on a non-planet besides our moon?
Wow, wow. That's a great question. That is a great question. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that with the Hayabusa probe. I mean, it's an impressive feat, but when you put it in that light, even more so that... that they were able to do that and get it back too. I'm guessing that at least some of these three that have successfully landed elsewhere haven't made it back probably, because that would be another difficult thing to account for.
Well, Hayabusa is one of the three, so there's two others.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Only three times. So, and here's the thing about Hayabusa. I'll throw in a little bonus here. Hayabusa is a partial screw up, because Hayabusa had a little Minerva robot lander that missed the asteroid. Because there's a signal that these probes have automated, you know, sort of sequences, you know, adjust your orbit, do this, that, against other, you know, stimuli, and sort of as this happens, you know, thrust up so you don't crash, that kind of thing. They sent the signal to drop the little lander, and between the time they sent it and the time it got there and the light speed delay, the orbiter, the probe had an automatic increase orbit because it was getting something happened, got too close to the asteroid. So by the time it was told to drop the probe, it was thrusting up. So it literally just dropped this probe into space.
Oh man.
It dropped this little rover just like it's not flying somewhere into the cosmos, spinning its wheels gaily, hoping to someday land on something.
And it doesn't even have a picture of a hydrogen atom to keep itself company. So
not at all. Exactly. Let alone nudie pictures.
Yeah. Well, hey, Jay, I'm gonna bring us to a close here. Thank you very much. Definitely gave us a lot to think about. And, of course, people can always find out lots of great info at jgarman.net. So, well...
Thanks for plugging the website, and thanks for having me on, buddy.
Have a fantastic Father's Day. I hope the family takes care of you.
Yeah, right back at you, Chief.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Have a good weekend. Bye. As always, fantastic to hear from Mr. Garman. Like I said, I am going to try and take us out of here for just a minute. We've got some business to attend to and all that, so we'll do that. I will be back in just a couple of minutes. We're going to have Tom Standage from The Economist on, talking some real deep tech stuff with us in just a minute. So stay tuned. You're listening to WRLR, and this is Tech Talk.
WRLR. 98.3 FM.
All Custom Electronics Incorporated offers service for all of your audio and video needs. Surround yourself with many audio and video possibilities. Dream a system and All Custom Electronics Incorporated can put it together. They have many brands of equipment available. Their services include installation of in-wall, in-ceiling, surround sound, home theater, and commercial electronic sound systems. Also, multi-room audio, video, and low-voltage systems. All Custom Electronics Incorporated is a proud sponsor of WRLR and assisted with the design and building of WRLR studios. They have over 14 years of experience to help you design and build your dream sound system. All Custom Electronics can be reached at 847-254-1234 or at allcustomelectronics.com.
The Lake County Journals cover what matters most to you. Local news, sports, weather, and entertainment are in print each week and updated often online at lakecountyjournals.com. You can look to both to find out more about your community and your neighbors. At lakecountyjournals.com, there are interactive videos and photo galleries. or even a place to post your comment about a story. Lake County Journals and LakeCountyJournals.com, your life connected.
She's real fine, my 409. She's real fine, my 409, my 409.
Linen Barbershop presents the third annual Classic Car Craze on Sunday, June 27th from 12 noon to 5 p.m. Car Craze features classic and custom cars on display at 2050 East Grand in Lindenhurst. MMA superstar Clayton Guida will be a special guest. Also appearing for this fundraiser benefiting One Hope United will be Lake Villa Fire and Rescue, the Lake County Sheriff Canine Demo, and Stubbles the Clown. Last but not least, WRLR's very own Rich Starzik, host of Rock and Roll Revival, will be broadcasting live from Car Craze. If needed, the rain date will be July 11th. For more information about Car Craze, the phone number is 847-356-0679.
Had enough of living month to month, paycheck to paycheck, with little hope of ever getting ahead? No matter what your age or income level, tune into the Sherry Debt Freedom Show with your host, Sherry Ridge, every Wednesday at 1 p.m. on 98.3 FM WRLR.
All right, we are back. And let's see if we can bring on Tom Standage right away here. Now, Tom Standage is going to tell us exactly who he is, but he is with the...
Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Standage. I was just going to try and attempt an introduction for you, but I think since you're on, I will let you do it for yourself. Can you tell listeners who you are and where you're calling from, and then we can get right into talking about the reason why you're on.
Sure. I'm the editor of the Tech Quarterly at The Economist, and I'm also the editor of our website, economist.com. So I'm Mr. Technology at The Economist.
Fantastic. And I noticed, too, that you have actually your own website as well. Now, people can find out a lot of information about you at TheEconomist.com, but also Tom Standage, is it .net or .com?
It's .com, yes. .com. And that's where I tell you about the various books that I've written, many of which are about the history of technology. In fact, they're all about the history of technology, if you look at it the way I do. But so one of them is about the history of drinking, for example. But drink is a technology, so there you go.
So, well, certainly, yes, a grading drink and so on. And I also, too, was very interested in the one topic that keeps coming up here for us is, of course, the challenges that, I guess a good way to put it, is the challenges that traditional media has in relationship with the Internet. And, of course, for you, particularly, Trenchant, is about print media and how that is evolving or changing to interact with that. And I found your article is interested. It's not what we're here to talk about, but if people are interested about that, that is a great place to go look, is to dig through some of your articles on that. We're just great. And
thank you. I mean, The Economist is in a very privileged position that we haven't been harmed by the Internet at all. Our circulation has continued to go up for the past 26 years. So we are very unusual in that regard, that a lot of other people are hurting and we're hurting a lot less.
You know, that is interesting. I hadn't realized that. I know I went online, of course, to read some of the articles that The Economist has gotten, specifically, of course, these tech articles. Does The Economist have an e-book format, you know, iPad or, you know, a specific format designed for some of the e-reader technology that is out there?
Yes. We're the number one or number two periodical. It's a toss-up between us and Time magazine on the Kindle. We're on the iPad via Zinio, which is a sort of digital newsstand system, and we're going to have our own iPhone and iPad apps out in the next couple of months. So we're already on some devices, and we're coming onto others, and we'll be on quite a large number by the end of this year.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, that's great. That means it will be easy for people to find it. I've always been impressed with The Economist having made some very smart deals with groups like United Airlines, for example. That's probably where I read The Economist most frequently is when I'm flying. I fly a few times a month, and that's always the first thing I do is go and grab that free copy of The Economist that I can get.
Well, it's a good thing to take on a plane. There's a lot of words there. There's 70,000 words in each issue, and what we try and do is package up all the stuff that we think is important each week and put it in one place that you can take on the plane. And the crucial thing is when you get to the end of it, you kind of feel that you've done your duty and you are informed. And of course, the trouble with reading news on the internet, and we think this is one of the reasons that we have continued to do well, is that you never get to the end of it. There's always another page you could read. There's always millions of more pages you can read. So we're sort of filtering all of that, and I think that's why we've continued to prosper, because the more stuff there is out there, the more people value having a filter.
Yes. Yeah, and in fact, there's been some interesting research done just recently about the ability of people to obtain and retain information depending on the way that it's presented to them, including what seems to be a lack of that ability or a decrease in that ability when you're reading things that have hyperlinks in them. Whether or not those hyperlinks go anywhere, whether they do anything, just the fact that it's hyperlinked seems to make us less able to focus on the meaning of it and the intent of it. And I apologize, I don't have the that study information up directly in front of me, but I do have one of the articles from The Economist Tech Quarterly that talks about staying on target and the difference between, you know, getting your information and doing things productively online and why that's difficult today.
Yes, yeah, so one of our freelance writers actually for the Tech Quarterly has a very funny signature, and it says being a great writer is 3% inspiration and 97% not being distracted by the internet. And I think that's something, even if you're whatever line of business you're in, if you're any kind of information worker, you will be able to relate to that, because on the one hand, computers are great. They enable us to call up all this information. They mean that we can, you know, we can work wherever we are and so forth. That's great. But they also mean that if you're supposed to be doing something, they're also putting these distractions in front of you all the time. Oh, I'll just check my mail. Oh, I'll just look on Facebook. Oh, look, here's an interesting link. Oh, someone sent me this. And, you know, before you know it, you've followed a link to another link to another link and so forth. So one of the things we look at in the most recent Tech Quarterly is the rise of this software, which is supposed to prevent you from being distracted in this way. And in many ways, it's a sort of anti-technology, because it's about turning things off. It's about making parts of your computer not work. So the most draconian version of this is a bunch of programs. There's one of them called Freedom, and there's another one called Isolator and so forth. There's a whole load of them. They basically cut off your internet connection. And you have to you tell them how long you want to not use the internet for, and they then block the internet for, say, an hour or 2 hours or however long you want to sort of devote to working on your novel or writing that report, whatever it is you were supposed to be doing. And at the end of that period, it starts working again. And of course, if you really need to use the internet, you can restart your computer and then it overrides it. But the idea is that restarting your computer is a pretty drastic thing, whereas just opening up a web browser and having a quick look at Facebook is a, you know, just a click away. And people do seem to find that if they use these things, they can be more productive. They can wall off a certain amount of time to do things without being distracted by the internet. But of course, some people work doing things where they need internet access. They may be using some sort of online service as part of their work. They may be doing something where they're accessing stuff all the time. So for those sorts of things, there are another kind of program which can allow you to access some kinds of sites and block others. So you could then say, we're going to block Hotmail and Gmail and Facebook for the next 2 hours, but you can still get to your intranet or whatever it is that you're connecting to, so that you can get useful work done. And then probably the most gentle form of this technology is the rise of full screen modes in text editors, where all of the kind of menu junk is switched off. And you know how it is, you're struggling with a piece of text or with a presentation or something like that, and the temptation is to go and sort of start messing around with the fonts instead of actually fixing the text. So the idea is that this just reduces what you see on the screen to pure text on the screen, you know, white on black or black on white, but it's like sort of sitting in front of a typewriter. And in fact, one of my colleagues at The Economist is struggling with this, and he's considering going and buying a typewriter as a way of, when he wants to do some writing, forcing himself to write without the distractions of the internet being right in front of him.
Yeah, yeah. You brought up a big point, too, that I hadn't actually occurred to me, is I do, I don't know if you want to call it waste, but I do spend a lot of time when I'm writing, spending far more time on the formatting of the text that I'm entering than I do on the actual text that I'm entering. And I recall back in the, good old days with, my Amstrad and, where you couldn't do that. You had
no, they only had about one font or two fonts, and you could do bold, and bold italic was about as far as it got. Yeah, I remember that as well. So in a sense, it was easier to get things done because there were fewer options, and you wouldn't be messing around with word art and chart junk and all this other kind of stuff. You'd just be concentrating on the word. So yeah, that's very much the idea. And I think this is very much this whole question of are computers, yes, they increase our productivity, but they can also decrease it. And are they affecting our ability to concentrate on long-form things, on reading books and so forth? And, of course, this is the subject of Nick Carr's current book, The Shallows. And he looks at all of the various studies, including the one that you mentioned, but there have been quite a few of them, which suggest that the plasticity of the brain is such that if you grow up using, using the internet, using text messages, using short forms of text, that you kind of get used to consuming media in that way. And so what he's concerned about is that this means that people will, be reading fewer books, they'll be less interested in long articles, they'll just want to sort of snack on information. Now, I'm not sure I agree with him, because my own experience is that, my daughter, for example, who's 10, she reads, two or three books a day during the holidays if she can. She's an avid consumer of stuff, but yet she's very happy dealing with the internet and looking stuff up, on her computer and so on. So I don't think this is necessarily, an open and shut case, but I think it's very intriguing that there is this possibility that we're sort of, giving ourselves attention deficit disorder on a sort of societal scale through our use of the internet. Well, and that's the sort of nightmare scenario that he's presenting.
Well, and I wonder a little bit, too, if it isn't kind of the, the bemoaning of a lost day, kind of the, no one's really learning how to use buggy whips anymore, and they've lost the ability.
What it's more like, because this is a technology, it's a medium, this is a kind of moral panic, and there have been moral panics throughout history whenever a new technology comes along. I think it was Douglas Adams who said anything that existed when you were born, when you were growing up, has always existed. For my children, that's the internet. They've never known a world without it. Anything that's invented before you're 35 is cool, and anything that's invented after you're 35 is evil and must be stopped. And essentially, I see that. I'm 40, and I'm a gamer. I've been playing video games all my life, and there's a very sort of clear demographic shift about my age. Some people my age have been gamers all their lives as well, but some of them never kind of got into it when they were young. And so there's this kind of basically older cohort of people where most of them aren't gamers, and then you have a younger cohort where most of them are gamers. And so when you hear politicians talking about video games, they're usually in their 50s, and they usually talk about things like you get points for killing policemen. Well, I don't know about you, but I haven't played a video game that had points in it for quite a long time. So you can tell that they've never actually tried these things.
But anyway,
video games are supposed to be turning us all into, crazed cop killers. This is actually one of many such complaints. Novels were supposed to be leading people astray in the 18th century because, you would disappear off into a fantasy world reading a novel, and it wasn't even true, and people thought that was terrible, and people didn't even teach novels as literature until the mid-19th century. And basically all the people who grew up reading them thought they were great, and all the older people who thought they were terrible had to die out before novels became an acceptable and sort of respected form of literature. And then comic books were absolutely denounced in the 50s. They were supposed to turn children into drug dealers. Yeah. Rock and roll in the 60s was supposed to turn young kids into Satanists. Mm-hmm. The real problem there was that with the transistor radio, parents could no longer monitor the music that their children were listening to. You could take a radio into your room or out and about with you, or you could have one in your car, and your parents wouldn't be able to control what you were listening to. So they were very, very worried about the impact that this would have on society.
Yeah.
So in a sense, this kind of, oh no, the internet is making us all go mad, is a kind of version of that. But I think it's an intriguing thesis, and I think it's worth looking at. And my own experience is that, you know, there's at least a grain of truth here, because, you know, I certainly get more done if I go and work in the library where there's no Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, there's no question about that. And like you said, I mean, at least for those situations where you don't need access to the internet, you know, using, I guess the question, of course, that would come up is that, you know, shouldn't we, as, you know, you're 40, I'm in my 40s, so shouldn't we as mature adults, shouldn't we be able to manage our time, manage our interaction with distraction, and be able to control it without having to rely upon this draconian piece of software, as you put it, you know, something along those lines, which is going to completely shut us down and lock us out. And maybe the answer is no. Human nature is that we are just distractible apes. You know, that's how we evolved, was to be easily distracted, and you have to remove that in order to do what we want to do today.
Well, I think some people can, you know, can learn not to be distracted, but I think the point is that this software gives you the option. If you've tried that, it's like giving up smoking. Some people find it much easier than others.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the fact that you've got this option there is not a bad thing. Yes, you're right. Ideally, we shouldn't have to rely on technological fixes to human nature. You know, I think you just have to do whatever works.
Yeah, yeah, well, I, you know, the bottom line is you're absolutely right. I think if this is something that's going to help, and you are finding it difficult being distracted and so on, it's definitely something to be considered. I do think that the discussion is going to continue as to whether or not this is a bad thing, probably until our generation dies off, and then.
Yeah, exactly, and then no one will remember a world that was any other way. So, you know, in the Victorian era, people thought that telegraph wires were effective. The weather, and they thought that if you went in a train that went more than 25 miles an hour, you would suffocate. Which, you know, if you were sticking your head out of the window, and you would start to get hard to breathe. If you've ever stuck your head out of a car window, it's going quite fast, you know, it gets hard to breathe. But of course, you know, trains have windows, so it turns out not to be a problem. So very often, you know, in the infancy of a technology, you get all of these scare stories. You know, people are worried about mobile phones and cancer, and I think that's the same kind of thing. People were worried about VDUs giving you cancer when computers were first introduced into the workforce, into the workplace in the 80s. You know, people
yes.
were saying, "Oh, these screens, they're killing us." But
and wrecking our eyesight
do
as
anything.
Well. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, and that maybe that's a good segue to one of the other articles that was really intriguing. Is talking about these Wi-Fi signals, radio signals, all of these frequency and waves and electromagnetic radiation that is out there and in our living space, and there's now new technologies that are able to actually harness that and use that to power equipment, to power our cell phones and so on.
They can't power cell phones yet, but the hope is that someday you might be able to harvest some of this ambient energy, as it's called. And of course, ambient energy takes a lot of forms. The solar energy is ambient energy. There's light, at least for most of the day, or some of the day. And then there are other kinds of ambient radiation that can be harnessed. But what some researchers have started to do is to try and harness radio energy. And the idea is that, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was young, I built a crystal radio.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to wind the coil, and you string up a big wire in the garden, and then you can tune in to radio stations. And there's no battery anywhere. The energy of the radio signals themselves are then picked up by the antenna, and then they go into the little earpiece that you have, and you can hear it. It's very, very quiet, but there is actually something, you know, there's energy coming out of the air that's making all of this possible. And it's really that on a grander scale, but if you can harvest this energy, and there are some researchers, for example, in Seattle who've done this, they're harvesting the energy from a nearby TV station, and they're using it to run little wireless sensors. The amount of energy is tiny, but as electronics become more efficient, the amount of energy they actually need to run also gets, you know, smaller and smaller. There's a guy at Nokia who reckons he can get something like 5 milliwatts of power out of the air, and other researchers think that's, you know, they can't quite figure out how he's done it, but the number that you can get seems to be going up, and then the power consumption of the phone seems to be going down.
Yep.
And you need something like 20 milliwatts to keep a phone in standby, and that will probably improve. So you can imagine a situation where you could have a phone in, you know, 5 years' time maybe, that can stay in standby indefinitely. And it's only when you actually make calls that the battery starts to go down. And then if you imagine that it has a solar panel or something like that as well on it, you can imagine a phone that actually never needs charging. It's always sucking up energy in whatever form it can find it, from the airwaves or from the sunlight.
Yeah. And I mean, it kind of, and of course, this is mentioned in the article too. It harkens back to, you know, what Tesla was doing back in the early 1900s. Is it something that at some point we would say, hey, let's not rely on ambient. We'll actually broadcast waves that are intended specifically to power our devices, even if that was done on a small scale.
I mean, he thought that the way you would actually deliver electrical power to households, that it could be done wirelessly. And so he wanted to do that. He wanted to build this kind of giant world system of giant towers that would deliver power and information directly to people. And he did a lot of experiments sort of turning on light bulbs at great distances. And it is actually possible to do this. You can use, you know, these days it's done with very finely focused microwave beams. Mm-hmm. So you can have a radio-controlled plane, for example, which is powered entirely by a microwave beam from the ground. And the grandest version of this scheme is called satellite solar power. And it's where you have giant satellites with enormous solar panels in orbit, and they pick up the sunlight and they beam it down to Earth in the form of microwave energy. And that's entirely possible, you know, technologically. It's just incredibly expensive, and you know, the cost of launching stuff makes it impractical at the moment. But that could change. So you can actually send power through the air. And there are a bunch of companies that are devising systems to do this with a range of technologies, microwave beams, various kinds of magnetic coupling, induction of various sorts. So you have a sort of magic desktop, and anything you put on it starts to charge, that kind of stuff. So there's a whole load of this going on. And in fact, it'd be, you know, you can see how you find it very easy to sell this to people. We've managed to get rid of nearly all the other wires that go into our computers these days. You know, I have a laptop, has a wireless internet connection. It doesn't have a keyboard or a mouse because it's a laptop. You know, basically the only thing I ever plug into it is the power lead. And it would be great to be able to get rid of that last wire. So there's a whole bunch of people, you know, following in the footsteps of Tesla and trying to make that dream a reality.
Yep. Yeah. Now, and I know I have seen, and this is a slightly different technology, although similar, is, you know, the type of thing where you can take your iPhone and place it on a pad and have it charge via the pad, where you don't actually have to plug anything in, that it's using some form of electrostatic induction or something along those lines, where it's actually going through the materials.
Yeah, there's a bunch of technologies that do that. They're a bit clunky at the moment because you have to put the phone into a special sort of sleeve which has the pickup for the power. And some of them are quite simple and they just use sort of studs that, you know, sit onto a sort of grid, and others are a bit more elaborate and use induction, electromagnetic induction, so you have a coil on each side. And that basically works the same way as a magnetic induction in a rechargeable toothbrush. It's the same principle there. Mm-hmm. And then the Palm Pre, I think, does this. It has the option of a wireless charger where you can kind of dock it magnetically onto something and it charges it. So there are early versions of this around, but they're still a bit clunky. And what we really need is a sort of standard to emerge so that you can then, you know, have a desktop that charges your laptop and powers your laptop and charges all your devices when you just sit them on the desk. And I'd certainly buy one of those. I think that'd be very convenient.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, I think you've hit it on the nose, is that, you know, until there's a standard developed, it's going to be a difficult battle to make this kind of a universal situation. Of course,
We see this very often, that, you know, you get kind of lots of people trying various forms of things, and then you need some big player to come in and say, okay, folks, this is the way we're going to do it. And, you know, Apple has done that several times in the past few years with different versions, you know, different in different respects. The thing I was really hoping they would put in the iPhone 4, which they didn't, is another one of these technologies that's nearly ready to go, which is wireless payments. And this is kind of like the EasyPass system or the touchless credit cards that, you know, are starting to appear. And you can do this in Japan. You can use your phone as your train ticket and your office pass and your, you know, you can make small purchases with it. So it can be your credit card as well. And what we really need is a big player to kind of bless this and say, yes, we are going to do this. And then, you know, everyone would take it much more seriously. But at the moment, we have sort of lots of smaller initiatives, and it hasn't really gained critical mass. And wireless charging is a similar situation. So it's one of these things that's bubbling under. And I think it's Paul Sappho, the futurist, likes to say it takes 15 years to have an overnight success. And when this finally happens, we'll all say, oh, it's finally happened. But it's, we're in that kind of 15-year period of people almost getting it right, but not quite.
Yeah, 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 it's true. I was pleasantly surprised recently on a recent flight that I took where I was able to use my phone as my boarding pass. They actually have finally gotten at least at that point.
So you had a barcode on the screen, and they scanned that. Is that how it works? It's a 2D barcode.
It's exactly right. Although it's not even a barcode. It's one of these blobby-looking things.
Oh, that, right, yeah, yeah. So it's a 2D barcode. It's square. Instead of lines. Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. That's it, exactly. And it worked very smoothly. I had to email it to myself first and things like this. But then as long as it displays on the screen clearly enough for them to scan it up, it was wonderful. Tom, I apologize. We're right at the moment where I'm going to have to close this down. I have this deep suspicion that we could continue talking for another 45 minutes, an hour, and still not have gotten through even the first couple of of articles that are available on the Economist.
Well, no, I love this stuff. You love this stuff. So you'll have to have me back another time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Please, let's keep in touch and make sure that, I know these happen quarterly. Maybe we can make it a regular thing even.
Okay, well, the next quarterly, that's coming up in September, so perhaps we should do that.
Fantastic.
The Tech Quarterly is up on economist.com now if people want to go and see it.
Fantastic. So check that out, economist.com. And, of course, we've been talking with Tom Standage from with his website, tomstandage.com.
Great. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you. Take care, Tom. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Wow, what a fantastic discussion we had. A wonderful time. Mr. Standage, if you hear this, definitely we will be back in contact with you. I think we will do that and connect with the next Economist Quarterly. What a blast. And let me tell you, if you're listening right now, we touched on maybe 10%, if even that, of the fantastic stuff that is available within the Economist Tech Quarterly this period. Go on to theeconomist.com. You'll find it. I'll give a direct link on our website at techtalk.wrlr.fm, of course. And you know what? That's going to be the cool site of the week this week. I apologize. We just pushed and pushed right out of time. So I'm going to leave you. You know who's going to come on right after me is John Solaric, and he's got some great music for you to listen to. But in the meantime, I'm going to inflict my music on you. Let's listen to a little Crisscross by the Guillemots, and I'll leave you on that. That's going to be the podcast-only song of the week. Live, you're going to be hearing, let's do a little Andrew Beard and Imitosis. This has been Tech Talk on WRLR. Thank you so much for listening in today, and we'd love to have you back next week. Take care. Have a great Father's Day, too.
It's not gonna give us bad advice. So go dance with your thunder and lightning, where your paradise birds are fighting. Let's shake things up and bear tonight. You we go!
Sky, so far.